Welcome to the James River Church Podcast. You're about to hear another inspirational message from David Lindell, West Campus Pastor at James River Church. It's our prayer that this message is an encouragement and blessing to your life.
It's a great day to be in church as we continue in our series on the Gospel of Mark, and we're actually going to land back in Mark chapter 11 this morning. So if you've got your Bible, go ahead and grab it, Mark chapter 11. And, you know, I love this season, and just a lot happening in the life of the church, but also part of what I love is just the time of year that it is, you know? How many fans of fall do we have in the room this morning? Like, yeah, vocal fall proponents. But I love, you know, like the cool, crisp mornings and the evenings. It's just like the sky and then the color of the trees. And also something that I love about the fall is that it's a great time to plant trees. And I really like planting trees. And so we moved into a new house. And the first thing I did before we moved anything else in is that I planted a tree. And I planted outside the dining room window and just wanted to, I just thought it would be really pretty, and it's a spruce tree and Siberian spruce. And so it's got a kind of a bluish green tint. It's not quite like a Colorado blue spruce, but it's more green than that, but it's just really pretty. And so I was really excited about it. And I would, even before we moved out there, I would go out there in the morning and check on it. Like before I went to work, I would get up early, and Becky probably thought I was doing something, you know, like, oh, you got to get into work early. Yeah. Yeah, go check on the spruce tree, you know. So since we moved in, though, I planted more trees because I just love planting trees. And so since we moved in, I've planted a Japanese maple. I've planted a coral bark maple. I've planted an autumn blaze maple. I planted a Colorado blue spruce. I planted a Hinoki cypress. Planted a weeping Norway spruce. I planted a forest pansy redbud. That's really pretty. And two Australian black pines. I may have a problem, you know. But I just love it. I love the, you know, all the colors. Like, I love the trees. But the first tree I planted, back to that Siberian spruce, I planted this little Siberian spruce, and it's just so cool. In fact, what I wanted to do, like, today is that I ended up digging it up. And I wanted to bring it in and show you. And if you're a tree person, you're like, that is a terrible idea. But, you know, like, if you're proud of your tree, you're proud of your tree. You know what I'm saying? So, but I brought it in, and I just wanted to show it to you. And there it is. There it is. So, the good news is Lowe's has a one-year return policy on all of their trees. And so if you work at Lowe's, I plan to see you tomorrow morning. I have my receipt. Yeah. The reason I brought this in, though, is, you know, I am the culprit. Like, I think I overwatered it. You can kill a spruce tree with kindness. I technically did kill it in all of my, you know, nurturing. It was overdone, I guess, but I killed it. I mean, I'm to blame, I think, between me and the hot summer. The reason I brought it in, though, is because Jesus and I have something in common. Because in the passage we look at today, Jesus kills the tree. Jesus kills. Look at this. Mark chapter 11, because it makes me feel better. Mark chapter 11, verse 12. On the following day, when they came from Bethany, he was hungry, and seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if he could find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the time or the season for figs. And he said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples heard it. Then he came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple, and he began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple. And he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. And he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple. And he was teaching them and saying to them, Is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. And the chief priests and the scribes heard it, and were seeking to destroy him, for they feared him, because all the crowd was astonished at his teaching. And when evening came, they went out of the city. What we have here in Jesus approaching this fig tree and then entering the temple is we have Jesus giving us an image, an illustration. It's really a metaphor for what he is going to then find in the temple. Because in approaching the fig tree and in coming into the temple courts, his assessment is the same. His concern is the same. That what he sees in the fig tree, or rather what he doesn't see in the fig tree, it alerts his disciples concerning what he thinks and feels about what he sees in the temple. Because what Jesus is doing in this passage is he is making his assessment of the lack of spiritual vitality present in the Judaism of his day. What he's doing is he's making an assessment of religion that's gone bad, that's run amok. And so when he goes to the fig tree and he finds no fruit, it becomes for us a picture of a barren temple and a system of approaching God that is broken. It's Jesus' autopsy of lifeless religion. You know, it occurs to me that if Jesus were to come into this room this morning, if he were to survey the hearts of people in this place, that he would likely assess the spiritual health of every one of us. And if he were to assess our spiritual health, if he would point out what's good and what's going on in our hearts that's not good, what would be the litmus test? How would he assess what he sees? How would he determine the spiritual health within your heart and in your life? What would he say to you? What would his assessment be of where you stand with him? You see, in this passage, as Jesus provides this autopsy of lifeless religion, he alerts us, in doing so, he alerts us to what he is looking for in the lives of his people. And so as we move through this passage and we look at Jesus' autopsy, we recognize that not only is he speaking to a fig tree and not only is he diagnosing the error of Judaism of his day and the corruptness of the temple, but he's also speaking to us about our own hearts. And this is the autopsy that he gives. Begin in verse 12, on the following day when they came from Bethany, he was hungry. Verse 13 says, and seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see it, to it to see if he could find anything on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves. Here's his first assessment. The first assessment of lifeless religion is that it only looks healthy from a distance. It only looks healthy from a distance. Now, it's interesting because what you read here is that Jesus then, finding no fruit on it, only leaves, it says, for it was not the season for figs, and he said to it, may no one ever eat fruit from you again. And then Mark adds, and his disciples heard it. I bet they did. You know, you've got to think like they're standing there, like they're just walking along. He says, you know, I'm gonna go up to this fruit tree and see if there's anything on it. And then the next thing they know, he's like, die, you know, like, no more fruit, you're done. You know, and you've got to think the disciples are like, oh, this is going to be a fun one. You know, like, because Jesus, the Jesus they know, he's like, I mean, he heals people. He raises the dead. He turns water into wine. He does not make a habit of going around and killing other people's fruit trees. That is not what he does. This is the only destructive miracle that takes place in Jesus' entire ministry. So this is shocking to the disciples, and I think it's somewhat shocking to us because of the way that the passage is written. It says that he found nothing but leaves, and then Mark adds, for it was not the season for figs. So we see Jesus, and this is Jesus, like loving, compassionate, kind, caring, gracious Jesus, come up to a tree. It's not even the season for figs. He's upset that there aren't any figs, and so he curses the tree. And we're all saying, wait, what? He curses the tree? Like, doesn't he know it's not the season for figs? Like, that's not cool. What we don't understand, though, is that, like, fig trees are like very prolific in, you know, in Israel. They're all over the place. In fact, we got a picture of a fig tree for you. What Jesus might have seen, this is a mature fig tree. And so they would grow about 20 feet tall and 20 feet wide. And in the spring of the year, in March or April, they would begin to bud. And what the passage doesn't say to us, because this is when Jesus would have been traveling, it's early April, late March, and he's moving toward Jerusalem, toward the Passover, and he sees a fig tree, but what he sees is he's seeing a fig tree that's just begun to bud. And what you'll notice is that it's the leaf is coming out, but there's also a little piece of fruit. It's like a pre-fruit. It's like a little nub at the end of the branch. And what travelers would do in ancient Israel is that if you're traveling, you're hungry, you could eat that. But I mean, it wasn't particularly good, but it was edible. It was a bitter, sort of a bitter fruit, and then it would fall off, and then the fig would begin to grow, and it would mature in August, and then you get maybe another crop in October. And so Jesus comes to the tree, and he's not just being vindictive and mean when he curses the tree for not having what it's not supposed to have. What he's looking for is he's looking for these little pre-fruit. He's looking for a snack to sustain him on the journey. And when he doesn't find that, what Jesus recognizes is that the tree is, something's wrong with it. There's a problem with the tree. The tree is diseased. Or it could be even that it's dead on the inside and then it hasn't manifest that on the outside yet. And Jesus recognizes this as a hallmark of temple worship in his day. This stands as a metaphor for what he is going to find, what he has found, and what he's going to find again in the temple worship. That from the outside, as people are streaming by hundreds of thousands into Jerusalem for the Passover, it's got all the hallmarks of worship. It's got all the hallmarks of healthy vitality spiritually. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of people coming, and there's a lot of people going, and there's a lot of transactions happening, and there's a lot of animals being sacrificed. But Jesus says, under the surface, there's no substance. What you see in the distance that looks healthy, what you see from far off that looks okay, it's actually not okay. It's a warning. It's a warning that what can happen in our lives, because Jesus is not just talking about the tree and talking about the temple. He's actually getting in our face. He's getting in my face. He's getting in your face. And what he's saying is, be careful. Be careful lest you project a certain health spiritually. Be careful lest you project a certain relationship with God or depth to your spiritual walk that's actually absent under the surface. Which is a warning that we find multiple times within the New Testament in different forms. In fact, Jesus, the beginning of Revelation, in Revelation chapter 3, the writer John pictures him walking among these churches, and he's assessing the health of different churches. And he says this in chapter 3 in verse 1. He says, "And to the angel of the church in Sardis write the words of him who has the seven spirits of God and the seven stars, I know your works. I know there's a lot going on. I know you're really busy. I know there's a lot of spiritual stuff happening. You have a reputation for being alive, but you are dead." Jesus says, you have a reputation. Everybody knows you as spiritually strong. Everybody knows you as on fire for God, but there's actually nothing really to it. Jesus' concern is that we would project, we'd be comfortable projecting a level of depth that we do not possess and somehow rest in that. And I think we've all perhaps known somebody that projected, like they played a good game. Like they had a lot of like Christian t-shirts and knew a lot of Christian music and told Bible jokes. And they were like from like, man, Mr. Christian, Miss Christian, like you met him at work and like, or you met him in the neighborhood and you're like, wow, well, it's like, wow, that is somebody we should put on the worship team. You know, like they're just, you know, there's a lot of health and vitality there. And like, well, look at their family. You know, I kind of watch them, you know, they're always early to church on Sunday. And you know, like it just looks awesome. And then you started to get to know them, and to your disappointment, what you found out is that under the surface, the foundation had all sorts of cracks in it. And in fact, when the storms of life hit, whatever they were projecting couldn't be sustained. Jesus' concern is that you and I would be known for our church attendance, or we'd be known for our generosity, or we'd be known for our passionate worship. And yet, though we're known for those things, none of those things would have any reality to them. It's just like the tree. Like, he found nothing but leaves. It looked healthy from a distance. And what's very scary about this truth regarding lifeless religion is that lifeless religion thrives undetected. It thrives under the surface. It thrives when nobody sees it. It thrives as long, because that's the whole thing. It wants to be seen from a distance, but don't get up close. Don't join a life group. Don't let people get in your world. Like, don't let them too close, and don't let them get to know you, because you know there are cracks under the surface, and you know things aren't the way they're supposed to be, and so don't let anybody get too close. But what happens is, the longer lifeless religion is harbored in any one of our lives, the more it begins to surface. You know, this tree was on its way out for a long time before I could see it in the branches. But what happens is lifeless religion begins to manifest itself. And what happens is, as it begins to dry up, here are some of the ways that it begins to manifest itself. There's no depth. If I dig down around the root ball, like it's not going deeper. It's not going deeper. And in fact, now if I take this tree and I put it in the ground and I don't stake it like on five sides, the first time we get a heavy storm, what's going to happen? It's going to fall over. It can't sustain the storms of life. It can't sustain heavy winds. It can't do any of that because there's no roots, there's no depth. This is the first way lifeless religion surfaces. But also, lifeless religion does not bring about change. It doesn't bring about, you just stop growing. When you adopt and you harbor lifeless religion, growth and vitality, it just stops. You cap out. Like, this tree is not going to get any taller. It was supposed to be 40 feet tall. That ain't happening. It's just going to be this tall. Like, that's all it's going to do. It's not going to be. In fact, not only is it not going to get any taller, it's just going to lose stuff. Like, anytime anything bumps up against it, it's just going to lose. It's going to lose. It's not amassing any more needles. It's not putting on any more foliage. All it's doing is losing, which is the way lifeless religion functions. If you say, I'm going to stay stagnant and I'm going to stay right here, you're not only just going to stay right there, you're actually going to go backwards. That's what happens. Jesus is saying, this is the warning. That's what lifeless religion produces. And not only can it not yield change, and not only is there no depth, but also this tree can no longer respond to healthy environments. It can't. Like, it doesn't matter if I take this tree and I put it in a hole. Sorry, guys. If I put it in a hole that's perfectly dug for it, and it's getting the perfect amount of sunlight and the perfect amount of water, if I don't kill it by overwatering it, and if I fertilize it properly, is this thing going to grow? No. It's not. There's some of you in here this morning, and you find yourself leaving church again and again and saying, you know what? I just didn't get a lot out of it today. Well, was it church or was it you? You find yourself saying, you know what? I just, you know, with the worship team, the songs we sing, they just don't do a lot for me. Are they the songs or is it you? Because when lifeless religion has pervaded the inside of a person's heart, when it's been given harbor, it now can't respond in a healthy way to a healthy environment. So if you've harbored that in your heart, what happens is your responsiveness to health around you diminishes. You can take in less and less of the nutrients. You can take in less and less what would feed your soul and bring vitality and bring health. You just can't do it anymore. You know, what's interesting is a healthy tree, if you put it in the ground, it will fight for life. It will suck the nutrients. If there's any nutrients to be had in the soil, it'll suck them out until it can't anymore. But if something's dead, it doesn't matter how much fertilizer is there, or how much you water it, or how much sunlight it gets, it cannot respond to its environment. Jesus says, here's the danger of lifeless religion, that it dries you up and it steals your depth. that it prevents you from growing in the plan and the purposes of God. All of a sudden, you stop growing, and in fact, you start going backwards, and then you begin to lose your ability to respond to what God is doing around you. Healthy from a distance, diseased up close. Jesus says, this is the first, in my autopsy of lifeless religion, this is the first danger that I see. He also says, though, that when lifeless religion is present, what happens is the tree no longer produces fruit. Lifeless religion doesn't produce any fruit. Look at what we find in verse 13. And seeing from a distance a fig tree and leaf, he went up to see if he can find anything on it. But when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves. It's important for us to note that this parable is really the continuation of a parable that he preached starting back in Luke chapter 13 and verse 6 through 9. Look at what he says here. He says, and he told this parable, a man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard. And he came seeking fruit on it and found none. And he said to the vine dresser, look, for 3 years now I've come seeking fruit on this fig tree and I find none. Cut it down, it's just taking up space. Why should it use up the ground? And he answered him, sir, let it alone for this year also until I dig up around it and put manure. Then if it should bear fruit next year, well and good. If not, you can cut it down. Jesus says, that time has passed. As he assesses the temple and he assesses Judaism of his day, he says, there's been no repentance and there's been no change and there's been no forward motion. In fact, we're just going backwards and I was ready to cut it down earlier, but now is the time. This is done. This whole thing is coming to an end. This whole thing is rank with lifeless religion. And the reason Jesus says that he sees the need to cut it down is that it's not producing fruit. If it's not producing fruit, then what's happening? What's going on? Jesus says lifeless religion, one of the hallmarks of lifeless religion, is it no longer produces fruit. Time has passed, and all that's been revealed is that the worship in the temple is bankrupt of any spiritual life. It's interesting what James writes in James chapter 2 and verse 17. He says, faith by itself, if it does not have works, is dead. James' point isn't that works save, it's that saving faith works. That when a person has experienced God's power, when your faith is vibrant, when your faith is alive, when you're walking with God in the way that you should be walking with God, when you're saying no to sin and yes to his plan and purpose being accomplished in your life, what happens is that manifests itself on the outside. In the form of fruit. What does fruit look like in your life? What should it look like? What is Jesus looking for? Well, in the life of a Christian, what fruit looks like is it looks like change. What's happening? There are things that used to trip you up that no longer do. There are things that you used to get entangled by, and there are thoughts that you just couldn't. There are addictions, and there are all sorts of things that just had you knotted up, and there are things that you just didn't even notice, but now you've been walking with God for years now, and all of a sudden you look around and you say, wow, I don't struggle with that anymore. Fruit. What you do is you look at your life and you say, wow, I've become so much more generous. My life has got so much more joy in it. I'm so much more at peace. There's so much more grace in my speech and in my life and in the way that I treat people. Fruit. It's fruit. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control. All of a sudden, I look at my life and I start to see all this fruit. Wow, there's a lot of self-control that I never used to have before. Wow, there's a lot of peace that was just not present. All of a sudden, there's fruit. Why? Because I've just been walking with Jesus. And all of a sudden, what I ultimately find out is that I'm a lot more like Jesus than I used to be. That's fruit. That's what he's looking for. That you're changing. You're becoming more like him. The danger is that we find ourselves content and comfortable staying in one place. All of a sudden saying, you know what? I'm good right here. I don't really push myself in terms of, I'm a Christian and I go to church on Sunday and I give in the offering every once in a while, so leave me alone. And what happens is the fruit's just drying up. If you're the same in your spiritual journey that you were a year, two, 3 years ago, Jesus says, I have to tell you that you've got a hallmark of lifeless religion. That you've bought into a lie that somehow your faith has been reduced down. And you find yourself living without the spiritual vitality that I've called you to. This is a warning that the Apostle Paul echoes in 1 Corinthians, or rather 2 Corinthians 13. He says, examine yourselves to see whether you're in the faith. Test yourselves, or do you not realize this about yourselves, that Jesus Christ is in you unless indeed you fail to meet the test. The call is to look under the hood of your life and say, you know what? Is there growth? Am I healthy? Am I healthy underneath the surface? And am I producing fruit? Wherever I look, I see Jesus changing me, and I see him strengthening me, and I see myself stepping more and more, wading into the pool of faith to say, God, do something in my life and do something through my life. Jesus says, my autopsy of lifeless religion finds that lifeless religion is healthy from a distance, but up close it's diseased, and it doesn't produce any fruit. But he also says that lifeless religion becomes a haven for what God hates. Look at this in verse 15, and they came to Jerusalem, and he entered the temple, and he began to drive out those who sold and those who bought in the temple, and he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons, and he would not allow anyone to carry anything through the temple, and he was teaching them and saying to them, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations, but you have made it a den of robbers. Have you ever stopped and thought about that last phrase, verse 17, you have made it a den of robbers? It's as if Jesus is saying, okay, you've got the entire planet and you've taken the most sacred space on the entire globe and you've made it a criminal lair. This is what lifeless religion produces. It takes a place that was dedicated to God and dedicated to the worship of God, and what does it do? It invites all sorts of other things that should not be present. It has a corrupting effect on your affections. It has a corrupting effect on your desires. It will invite in what should have never been there. And this is what is happening in the temple courts. That under Caiaphas, some say that this has only been going on like 25 or 30 years, that Caiaphas, the high priest, what he does is he starts this practice of inviting merchants and these guys, extortioners, really into the temple courts. It may have started innocent, but it seems that Caiaphas had a goal in mind, which was personal enrichment and enrichment of the other chief priests. What his desire was is he invited these extortioners into the temple courts, and what they did is they drove up the price of the sacrificial animals and the exchange rates to pay the temple tax, because the temple tax had to be paid with the temple shekel, and so you'd bring your currency and you'd exchange it for the temple shekel in order to pay the temple tax at Passover. Well, Caiaphas has worked with these guys to drive up the rates, and so now you bring your animal, you bring your lamb, you bring your dove, and you bring it into the temple courts, and the priest looks at it and says, oh, I'm sorry, that one's not going to work. You probably need to go buy another one that meets our standards. This one's kind of got a blemish. You need to go buy one that's unblemished. And so you sell your animal at a reduced price and buy another animal for a higher price. And they benefit. What's so sad about this is what Mark points out. He says, Jesus, he alone points this out in this way. He says in verse 16, the end of verse 15, he says, he overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold pigeons. What's significant about that? What Mark wants us to understand is that Jesus turns over the tables of those who are exploiting the poorest of the poor. Because if you were really poor, what you were permitted to do is you didn't have to come up with the money for a lamb, you could just bring a pigeon And Mark says, these guys are so corrupt. It's so much about them that they don't even see what they're doing to the poorest of the poor. They're willing to exploit the most vulnerable people among them for personal profit. And all of this points to the fact that lifeless religion breeds a pride that makes worship all about me. It's all about them. It's all about what they can get out of it. All of a sudden, it's all about their wealth. It's all about their enrichment. And if we're not careful, if lifeless religion is given safe harbor in our lives, what happens is that it makes our worship very me-centered. It's about my comfort, well, and my preferences and my desires, and if it's conducive for my schedule. Lifeless religion becomes all about me. It's very much pride-centered, and the tragedy in that is this, that Scripture tells us again and again that where pride is present, God is distant. James, in James chapter 4 and verse 6, he says this, God opposes, he opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. The psalmist writing in the Old Testament in Psalm 138, he says, though the Lord is great, he cares for the humble, but he keeps his distance from the proud. Where there's pride, where pride is entered into the equation of your worship, where pride is found harbor in my life, what it does is it drives a wedge between me and intimacy with God. So all of a sudden, because my worship is about me, it terminates on itself. Instead of doing what worship is meant to do, bring glory and honor and praise to God and draw me close to Him. But Jesus, the pinnacle of Jesus' disappointment is not just with their pride. He says this in verse 17, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all the nations. That popular in Judaism of Jesus' day was the belief that when Messiah came, he would cleanse the temple. But their understanding of the cleansing was that Jesus, or the Messiah, they didn't believe Jesus was the Messiah, but that the Messiah would drive out all the foreigners. So it would just be our people. Like, won't it be great when it's just Jews? Instead of like all these Gentiles around. And so they believed that that's what Messiah would bring about, that he would bring that sort of cleansing of the temple, that he would cleanse it of all the people that made religious life so inconvenient. Which was in total contradiction to what God had said in the Old Testament in Isaiah 56, which is what Jesus is quoting. It's the exact opposite of what they said, what they thought. That in Isaiah 56, what God proclaims is that there's coming a day where what he will do is he will graft in, he will incorporate in all sorts of people who weren't Jewish, that he would bring them into the family of God, that he'd bring in all sorts of outsiders, and that's what Jesus is so disappointed by. Oh, wow, you've missed it. This isn't just about you. This is about the entire world. Here's the sad thing, though, that lifeless religion always starts to insulate and exclude. Because it's so about my preferences and it's so about my comfort that what ultimately happens is I say, you know what, this is really just about me and it's really just about our group. And so it cuts the heart out of any sort of outreach to all the people who so desperately need to hear the good news about Jesus. It cuts the heart out of it. All of a sudden, there's a diminishing desire to tell anybody about what God would do in their lives. All of a sudden, there's a diminishing desire to bring new people in. All of a sudden, there's a diminishing desire to reach out to people who are on the outside or on the fringe or who aren't like us. And Jesus says, that's the gospel. But what's happening is the good news, this glorious message of redemption for all creation is being shrunk down to an exclusive few. When Jesus proclaimed the message of the gospel that we find John 3:16, for God so loved the world that he gave his only son that whosoever would believe in him would not perish but have eternal life. Whosoever. You know what? If you came into this room this morning believing that it was just about an exclusive few, guess what? I've got really good news for you. It's not. It's the whole world. It's whosoever. And so no matter where you've been or where you've come from or what's going on in your heart, he stands ready to have a relationship with you. My house should be called a house of prayer for all the nations. Oh, no, no, it's not just this exclusive group of people. It's for you. Jesus says, lifeless religion excludes. Lifeless religion pushes people out. I'm calling people in. Amen. He's talking to you this morning. He's talking to me this morning. That wherever I find lifeless religion, that I would acknowledge it, and turn from it and find in him something more powerful, not only to come overcome the lifeless religion that perhaps has taken root in my heart, but to live out his plan and purpose in my life. Let's pray.